Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where frontline sales leaders teach you how to build and scale an outbound sales team. Welcome to a special edition of the Predictable Revenue Podcast. I'm your host, Colin Stewart. Today, I'm joined by my co-host, Aaron Ross, and this is episode 100. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Yeah, 100. Flies by.
I know, man. I mean, you're the one that got this thing kicked, you know, up and running. You recorded, I don't know, the first five episodes. I think we sort of wove those into the beginning, and this was really sort of your baby and getting this off the ground. And then I sort of jumped in and took it for a ride.
Well, I am at this point, I feel like an expert in having babies. So
I will give you credit for that much.
Thank you.
So I wanted to get Aaron back on the show. We're going to talk about some of our favorite episodes. Not just for like who we liked the most, but also I think what we got the most out of personally here at Predictable Revenue. So we're going to talk about some of the episodes that we've actually taken and implemented here. And we're going to talk a little bit about sort of how we did that. And Aaron, why don't you kick it off? Because we interviewed Jeff Davis, who's speaker revenue consultant, and we talked about sort of alignment with the revenue team. So why don't you tell me what you like there and how that works at Predictable Revenue?
Yeah. So with the Jeff Davis episode, again, this topic around revenue team, it really strikes close to home because that's one of the new topics we added to the, there's a second edition of the From Impossible to Inevitable book that's out or coming out June 1st. And that's, so a new idea is just adding to the mix. So with Jeff, go back to, if we step back, right, there's always a sales and marketing divide. And this has been going on for decades. I think it's actually a lot closer than it used to be because one of the key things that helps bridge sales and marketing are SDR teams, whether they're inbound or outbound. But yet there's still this divide between the two. So how do you, instead of having sales and marketing working together sometimes, a little bit at odds sometimes, really operate having as a revenue team? So there's really that alignment between everybody. So the first step we can agree on are that you really need one revenue leader. Some companies now more popular title is CRO. So maybe it's a chief revenue officer, a VP revenue, someone who's overseeing both sales and marketing. A lot of companies who don't have that role, the default is the CEO or COO, right? So CEO or COO sort of manages the head of sales and marketing, but where that goes wrong, so when you do it that way, when the revenue leader is that CEO, COO, they still need to be hands-on in ensuring that the goals and metrics and everything set are, everything's aligned. So the problem is when you don't have that one revenue leader with the right title, CRO, VP revenue, and it's kind of defaults to the CEO, they may not be hands-on enough. Mm-hmm. And one person setting the tone that really ensures that from the top down, sales and marketing are aligned. So that's the first step. I loved a tip that Jeff had, which was ensuring that sales and marketing experience each other's kind of, honestly, jobs or roles. And it's that sales understands what marketing does, marketing understands what sales does. And there's really no other way to do that than for them to kind of switch jobs or to shadow each other. Like everyone needs communication. It always has to be like regular meetings between the two, but it's not the same to talk about things as when you actually have salespeople joining marketing meetings in some way. Or sales leaders joining, somehow there's a mix.
It's somehow right. Developing that empathy so that it's not just salespeople sitting on the other side going, marketing's throwing us all these garbage leads, and then marketing sitting on the other side saying, well, you know, the salespeople, we send them all these good leads and salespeople call them garbage and never follow up. And so yeah, I think, it's just developing empathy.
Yeah, and you do that by sitting in their shoes. Mm-hmm. Right? So that could be, attending, marketing people sitting on sales calls or salespeople joining marketing meetings, planning strategy sessions, or helping write collateral or website copy. It's one thing to say, oh, hey, this white paper is unintelligible or sucks or some version. Okay, well, what do you do to help them make it better? So that's that next step, I think. So first, have a leader. Second, just make sure the sales and market people on the different sides are experiencing each other's jobs since they really understand, have the empathy, rather than just complaining about what other people are doing or not doing. Third step I mentioned too is make sure you have an SDR. For almost every company, some kind of SDR team. because that helps bridge that gap. That solves a lot of problems when, for example, when marketing is generating leads, and marketing's job is not to generate leads, it's really to generate sales opportunities. And the SDR team ensures that a lot of those leads, the right leads, get taken further along to make to be really sales ready. It's just impractical and it just does, for a lot of reasons, it doesn't make sense for salespeople to get many leads straight from marketing and be expected to follow up on them diligently. It's not realistic. There are exceptions, but usually it's just, it doesn't work. That's why there's that divide. So SDR teams, whether inbound SDRs, outbound SDRs, really help bridge that gap. And a last point that Jeff made is, so this decision on who the ideal targets are, let's say the ideal target market and the companies in those markets, what should our positioning be? How should we campaign to them? And what should we say? The senior leadership should be involved to some extent in that to ensure that alignment and that the game, the phone message game doesn't happen where, you know, this C-level set something, it gets passed to marketing to flush it out, then it gets passed to sales. And by the time it gets there, it's lost the original intent. So just being a little more, basically a little more hands-on from the top level, especially, and also bringing them together. So to ensuring that the important stuff is aligned across the top, you know, the senior people, marketing and sales, all the way down to potentially, I mean, you're not gonna have senior people writing email copy, I actually could, but they should at least know what their people are saying, mm-hmm. have some sense of it. And, you know, how should we reach out to people? Are we going to be doing calling, emailing, direct mail, some sort of, you know, more complex sequence or online ads or, you know?
Yeah, like at the high level, strategic level.
And yeah.
And I think the important the piece that I got out of Jeff that I loved was that the CEO, the CRO, that senior, there needs to be a senior person at the table who's responsible for we're going after these customers specifically. Not, we want to go into this market and here's the total addressable market. Why don't you go and try and tackle every one of those?
Go figure it out.
Yeah, go figure it out. And then that job gets pushed down to the VP of sales and that job gets pushed down to the director of sales and that job gets pushed down to the account exec. And they're like, go figure it out, go figure it out, go figure it out. And then you've got these account execs that are on Google going, how do I figure out? Like, yeah, who is our target customer? Okay, maybe I'll just go and Zoom Info and I'll look up some people and I'll, you know, or you've got sales development reps, you know, going around through your database and or Salesforce saying, oh, I'm just going to email these random 100 people, right? And if the senior leadership team isn't giving you a strong list of these are the people we feel are the top sort of, you know, 100 customers we could ever deal with, here's the top 1,000, here's the sort of rest of them. If the senior team isn't involved in that decision and producing that list of customers, then you're going to have a problem. Because it doesn't matter if it's the wrong list, you're pointing in the wrong direction. It doesn't matter how good everybody down below you does. If you're pointing in the wrong direction, you're booking meetings to the wrong people, you're trying to sell to the wrong people, you're closing the wrong deals, you're either effectively selling churn or you're not selling anything at all. And I think the piece that I love from Jeff was that alignment's got to come from the top.
Yep. Amen. Last couple of things, you know, that we also talked to Lars Nielsen, who mentioned too, sales development should have a seat at the management table. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Zora is a credible, you know, a hyper growth company, went from 1 to 150 million in revenue in something like less than 10 years. I don't remember the exact number, valued at a billion or a couple of billion. They have a VP of marketing, a VP of sales, and a VP of sales development. And I think that should also be more common. But normally at the point where you have a team, if you're really early, maybe not, but that head of sales development needs to be a part of this at the same level. Once you've gotten to the point where it's developed, it's working, it's really helping tie sales and marketing together. And for those often generating a significant or most of the pipeline for a company or for a new business. Mm-hmm. So to wrap up the revenue team section, the last thing that I would add in is having marketing, especially, have a quota around qualified pipeline, qualified leads, right? What do you call it? Sales ready pipeline, sales ready leads, qualified opportunities, but not just measuring them on to new leads or other versions of metrics. Really, the job is to generate pipeline for sales. So having a quota or commit along that metric, because that's really at the point that sales cares, And when they have that same number they both care about, again, that solves a lot of problems.
Totally agree. And how we've implemented this at Predictable Revenue is we have the whole, we don't have a sales team and a marketing team. We call them the Rev team. They all sit in the same area. They share the same goals. They have the same leader. And so it doesn't matter if you're on the marketing side, if you're on the sales side, it's all one team, and it's the shared goal, which is sort of number of meetings that we book, number of sales that we close, right? And those are sort of the two metrics that we look at closely. And yes, we have a VP marketing. Yes, we have a leader of sales development. Yes, we have account execs and marketing individuals. But I think from any company, it's different than any company I've ever worked, because we're focused because we see ourselves as one team, as opposed to marketing sitting somewhere else. And it doesn't have to do with location, but I think that, you know, that could be one piece.
It matters though. I mean, it's easier when people can see each other in one spot. You can't always do that, but when you can do it, it helps to mix people, because, you know, people tend to talk to the people they're near and learn from people they're near.
Yeah, for sure. And then when it comes down to our, you know, our regular management meetings, is we have both sales, marketing, and sales development all represented at those meetings. And so each party or each team is getting an equal say. And I think that's a really important piece, because it's, you're going to highlight discrepancies. You're going to find, you know, areas where you're not necessarily aligned. And I think a lot of the sort of dance of doing a rev team right is finding those, finding how to, you know, get really good attribution on your marketing and help salespeople understand why it's so important, you know, to track the outcomes, because that's sort of a feedback loop to the marketing team so they can book them better meetings. And so I think the more that, you know, like Jeff talked about, the more that they experience each other's jobs, the more that they sit close to each other, the more that they understand the how, the what, and the why they exist, the better they can all sort of work together. And I think that's one thing that, you know, not trying to toot our own horn, but, you know, this is the rev team that we have, I think, works really well together. And it's unlike any revenue team that, or sales team or marketing team that I've worked on. And I've sat on both sides of the fence. And now we're right down the middle, and it's kind of nice.
Yeah. And also we see a lot of the problems with clients who aren't aligning things yet or have misaligned metrics. It's always a work in progress, but it makes everything easier when people have the same kinds of goals to work towards versus having different goals and are trying to, you know, coordinate them. So in a way.
Yeah, for sure. Which kind of brings us to the next one, which was Jamie Buss, just like blew my mind when it comes to forecasting. She's the VP of sales over at Zendesk. I don't know if you've heard of them, but they're doing about $500 million in revenue, and she's forecasting their quarters within 1%. Like, mic drop. That blew me away. If anybody's read The Hard Thing About Hard Things, Mark Cranney was, in my opinion, the hero of that book. Mark, if you're listening, you're probably not, but if you are, I love you. And Jamie, same. She got to learn from Mark Cranney when she was over at A16Z or Andreessen Horowitz. And she learned his method for forecasting deals. She taught them to us. It blew my mind. I instantly turned around and said, we eventually need to do something about this. Recognize the irony there. I realized, hey, we need to do something about it. It took me a couple of months to actually get it in place. But once we did, man, I feel like I leveled up as a human that's been in sales, you know, whatever you want to call my role, sitting on top of the sales team. I finally had a common language to talk to reps about the different deals that we were working on for the first time in managing salespeople, you know, and it sounds so simple. And we had very strong definitions for what our sales stages were. We had very strong definitions for what BANT was before. And it's hard to pinpoint the exact pieces, but I think my two sort of favorite parts of what sort of really opened it up for me was with Jamie's sales stages was for each stage, there was one single customer verifiable outcome that if you achieve this, it moves from this stage to the next stage. So it starts off in, I think it was qualify. And then in order for it to move from qualify to discovery, customer has to show up to a call, to the first call with an account exec. Perfect. To move from that stage to the next stage, they have to bring all the relevant stakeholders and show up to the next call, right? To move to the next stage, you have to be able, the rep has to be able to articulate to the boss or the manager or whoever, why clearly and intelligently, why do nothing is off the table, right? And then from do nothing is off the table, it's a verbal go ahead, you know, which is pretty obvious. And then from there, it's the sort of financials and how you pay. And I think to me, that just brought so much clarity around, you know, it just removed any form of subjectivity from the sales stages, right? Because you can look at, oh, qualified discovery, you know, proposal, needs validation, whatever. Like every Salesforce instance that's ever been set up in the, you know, since the dawn of time, you know, no salesperson has ever agreed on what discovery actually means or why a deal should be in there.
Yeah, it's tricky. Well,
yeah.
And every call is different.
For sure. And then for me, I think that the piece that like, that made me realize I've been doing it wrong my whole life was that you sort of think, you know, single track, right? A sale happens in like these stages. And then what sort of Jamie, like when she shared her qualification methodology with me, it really opened my eyes that, okay, there's this single track, yes, and that customers are going to progress along that track, correct. But then on top of this, there's a whole other layer. It was like, my entire life, I've only been able to see black and white, and suddenly I see color. There's this whole other dimension, which is the sort of qualification. And we went through, she was using MedPick, which essentially, I won't go into all of it, but it basically documents all the different pieces that you need to be able to, not, it's not necessarily about forecasting and about like, the methodology itself isn't about forecasting and saying, as a sales rep, I think it's going to close here, it's going to close there. It's about eliminating uncertainty and making sure you're asking the right questions and really understanding. And I think the piece that that I really liked about the conversation is it made us take the sort of, there were sort of three pieces that it made us take seriously, which was the identified pain, which as salespeople, we all talk about that. But the thing that sort of, that really did it for me was the metric. And so the I in MedPick is identified pain and the M is metric. And to me, those two are the, you know, the most important. And I think Jamie had a third one, which is probably economic buyer. But to me, it's those two that work in conjunction. And identified pain is exactly how it sounds. This is the pain that the customer is experiencing. And then the metric is how you quantify that pain. And to me, that just sort of opened things up quite a bit. And now it's sort of taken all the conversation our AEs are having to a much deeper level. And then on top of that, you know, we had one of Jamie's partners come on the show in a later episode, and he showed us how to build all of MedPick into, I'll be honest, we dropped the P because our deal sizes range from about 30 to 100K. And so P, which is paper process, just didn't make sense for us. So we ended up dropping that. So we're just Medic, which is way more fun to yell out in the audio, in the office. we implemented that in Salesforce. We had a score. And now when I do my pipeline review with our team, we have a common language that it's not just me quizzing and challenging people, it's the whole team that gets involved. And I think having that common language or implementing this process at the first time, I felt like we've all had this common language that we all agree on, that there's no, oh, well, this, well, that. It's like, no, this is how MedPick works, and this is how the stages work. And it takes away any subjectivity.
Yep. It makes sense. And when you have that, a little more of that objective steps, something happened to the customer, or there's a metric, then makes it easier to be more consistent. Which means less, I mean, it's easier along the way because there's less debate, there's less trying to guess, there's less questioning. It's just, did it happen or not? I mean, nothing's ever perfect, but the more you can rely on those objective steps and some metrics, easier it is. More consistency means more predictability too.
Yeah. And I'll be honest, like as the sales, you know, leading the sort of the revenue team here, I've sometimes struggled with, you know, I spent a lot of time in sales and I've led salespeople before. I think one of the things I struggled with was sort of feeling like I was really adding value to the process other than just sort of babysitting and making sure reps were taking care of their deals. You know, I was doing the basic, you know, the one-on-ones, making sure they're, you know, we're developing their career and working on skills here and there. But I think for me, this was, if you've seen the movie Twister, you know, it's the Dorothy. It's getting Dorothy inside the tornado. Now you can see what's happening on the inside. Because basically from this, we still do one-on-ones, but we do them less frequently. And on Mondays, we do a pipeline review where I sit down and we work through all the sort of later stage deals, and I get to challenge the team on Medic, and I get to, you know, from that Monday meeting, you know, the reps are going on and saying, okay, well, now I need to call this customer, I need to call that customer, just to make sure we're staying on top of things. And then on Friday, and this is sort of, I know I'm kind of bleeding in with another of our favorite episodes, and I don't know how much of this episode actually made it, because it's the one we did with the Brigal Sagemont guys, Aaron, where they talked about call scoring. Because on Mondays we do the pipeline review, which was heavily influenced by Jamie Buss, and then on Fridays we do call scoring, and we do it a couple different ways. We've got a team, remote office, that actually will go through, and we use Brigal's sort of 7 points to a perfect call framework, and then on Fridays the in person stuff, we review some of those scores, as well as we'll have the reps bring one troubled score or one troubled call to the team, and then we sort of work on it together. And I think the combination of those two meetings, plus adding in the MedPIC framework and the documented sales stages, made me feel like I'm adding value to the sales team in a way that I never felt like I was before.
Versus just kind of babysitting.
Totally.
Said, yeah.
Because there's, you know, we had Mike Stankus from Acquia on the podcast. He was really early, and he talked about, you know, there aren't any great schools for sales management, right? Like there are some schools now that offer sales courses, and there's some sort of continuing ed or some, you know, thought leaders that offer sales courses. And Mike happens to be one of those. And if I could remember the name of the sales course that he built, I would. I bought it. It was great. I can't remember the name. Mike Stankus, Acquia. I think he's the CRO of another company now, but Google him and you'll find his courses, or email me and I'll shoot you the link, because it was really great. But just there isn't a ton of like education out there for, you know, future sales managers. And I think I've got a typical sort of, it's in some ways a typical journey, is like I spent most of my life in sales. Now I manage salespeople. I also do some other things as co-founder, co-CEO with you, Aaron. And I've certainly learned a lot from people on the show and yourself as well. But I feel like I, in some ways, have the typical, like, you know, succeeded at sales, now I manage salespeople journey. And I think that's a pretty common feeling to say, okay, now I'm responsible. It's sort of like now I'm responsible for all these humans. It's sort of like, it's like the dog that finally catches the car bumper and is like, well, what do I do with it now?
Do I really want this?
Exactly. How do I do this correctly? What do I do next? It's like, I know I'm supposed to be good here. I know I have the experience, but how do I actually convert that experience into learning and value for other people?
Yeah. I mean, ideally you want your salespeople to feel like, yeah, when we have our management meetings, that it's useful, which is probably kind of rare, but there are ways to help with that, versus feeling like kind of a waste of time, or we're just going through the motions. There's no value for me. I'm just doing this because other, you know, my manager needs it. Mm-hmm. Kind of like CRM. Like, ideally you want salespeople to really get value from a CRM. Some people do. I know I used to can, and a lot of people just see it as, hey, I got to update stuff for other people, and then go back to my Excel sheet and post-it notes. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yep. I think I fell into that camp a lot. And I know our early sales team, I mean, we started off in Google Docs. You know, we were using Uber Conference, and we had Salesforce, and then, you know, Kay and Sean would take notes in a Google Doc, and myself as well. There's no criticism against Kay and Sean. They built out a great sales process. They built like our early call flows. They were two great salespeople, very experienced people. The thing that we sort of struggled with is when we made the transition to Salesforce from like Pipedrive, was everybody's sort of center of gravity is pulled into this single Google Doc template that you're just so used to going and clicking. And Google Docs is so easy to take notes in. And so I feel like it was super easy at the time, but when I go back and, you know, when deals come in from, you know, that talked to us 3 years ago, and they, you know, the Jason or Pete, you know, our account execs now, they want to, you know, find what happened to those deals. They don't know to go search their Google Drive. We also used to be carb.io, and now we're all predictable revenue. So it's in a different version of Google Drive. You got to go into the carb.io. So it's one of those things that I feel like we've got better and better over the years. And I think one of the tools that I've talked about a couple times on the podcast that I'm a big fan of that helped us get out of that was Dooley.ai. And I only recently realized that they probably named the company after the sort of phrase, like, duly noted. Like, that took me a while to I don't know. Maybe it was a pun, but it wasn't.
Who knows? Yeah. Maybe only them, I guess.
I'm trying to draw dots or lines between dots that don't exist. But I'm a big fan of that tool. It sort of got us out of the sort of, it helped us break that sort of Google Docs, not using Salesforce cycle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can get any way you can get people to get into one common system and actually use it. Sometimes it's easier, sometimes harder, but I mean, especially for executives, if you don't have an accurate dashboard, it just makes everything else harder. Mm-hmm.
For sure. I think the other thing that makes it harder is if you don't have, as the leadership team, like we talked about with Kim Brown, you know, going to, you know, making sure your team is pointing in the right direction at the right accounts, at the targeting the right verticals. I know you and I were talking about this one. Do you want to tee this one up, Aaron?
Yeah. Well, I was talking to Colin, you know, if I do a keynote or speaking, then one of these topics that I feel like it's always useful. People get tired of it And also people aren't doing it enough. It's around nailing a niche. Or again, if you're in Europe or Canada, nailing a niche. There's a reason why this was the part one of the From Impossible to Inevitable book, because it's really the most common problem if people are struggling to grow because they're not ready to grow because they haven't really nailed the niche. So Kim Brown talked in that episode, went through basically how the SDR team they have is very account based. So aligning from the top, like which targets we're going to go after in campaigns. And so the part of it, the section of that, that I think is the most relevant here is they saw that they looked at all the sources of revenue, and this was an ongoing process. They really realized that, wow, there's these certain, for example, we really got to target companies we have where they have 500 employees and up. And we really see almost all our revenue, 80% of it, from these five sub verticals, such as like transportation and machinery. And we're spending, they were, you know, targeting a lot more than that. But when they really hone in on which kinds of companies are actually, do we win at and drive the most revenue? So rather than scattering our energies over all these different types, trying to sort of see, hey, we could do all this stuff. When we hone in and focus on a few and do those better, it's like, let's focus on where we win. I know. But it's kind of funny.
Surprise, hey.
Yeah. It's funny to say that, but honestly, the opposite is normally true, which is companies are trying to spread their bets. Like, hey, everyone could use this, or feel like, hey, let's do, we know, maybe we do know we're doing well here, so we don't need as much work there.
Yeah.
And we can invest more in other places where it's harder. So, and there are times for that, but again, most often companies aren't disciplined and focused enough on really the ideal customers. You know, the companies and targets and segments that you have the highest chance of winning in, especially in outbound. So I think where this topic came from was earlier stage companies, typically, you know, maybe less than 10 million in revenue, who aren't used yet to doing cold or outbound marketing or outbound prospecting. They've gotten most of the revenue from word of mouth or customer referrals and such. And they start to reach out to customers who don't know them, whatever the mechanism is, through prospecting or marketing. And it's just a lot harder, and they don't realize how much harder it is. So, but when you're doing outbound or cold outreach and it's that much harder, like it forces you to really hone in on where you have the best chance of winning. Where are you the best at? Where are your strengths and focusing there? And it doesn't happen enough. Again, really, really common issue. Mm-hmm. So
it's one of the things that, it's one of the things I get pulled into a lot of conversations about, you know, how do I get my first 10? How do I get my first 100 customers? And I always like to get the entrepreneur to think about sales efficiency, right? You can go after this list that might not be your perfect customer, but your sales efficiency is going to be pretty low, right? So you might be able to convert a couple of them, right? But you might convert it like 1 in 100 are going to turn into a customer, right? And you might be happy with that, but what you're not realizing is that if you're going after, or when you're going after the right verticals for the right reason with the right messaging, your sales efficiency is going to be like 1 in 5, right? So of those 100, instead of 1, you're going to get 20 customers, right? And that should be really, that's really the goal that you're after. And that's really why you want to do it, all of this work that comes, that it comes with sort of discovering your ideal customer profile. It's really trying to figure out where are we best fit? Where are we a really strong fit for the market? And where are we going to get the best response, not just to our emails, not just to our cold calls, but to our value prop in general, and where are we going to, and which should translate into a really high close rate.
Yep. Or at least better than what we're seeing.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of companies we've been guilty of it as well. We're not, certainly not saying we're sitting here perfect in the ivory tower saying we've never made this mistake. I've made this mistake knowingly a number of times, both before and after recording the podcast with Kim. So like, no criticism on your side or on anybody's side if you're listening and you're doing this right now. I've done it too. Aaron's done it too. We've all sort of done this. We know, but I think it's the process of getting a little bit and a little bit better every time, sort of make sure that we're continuing to push things forward.
Yep. Unfortunately, you learn the most when you make the mistakes yourself. I mean, you can learn from other people's, but it doesn't really kind of stick unless you actually do it yourself too. And so most of these we've made in some way, shape, or form.
Yep. I was talking to one of our account execs at lunch today, and is one of my favorite Jerry Seinfeld quotes ever, which is, pain is just the sensation of experience entering the body.
Yep. Kind of like in the gym, I hear the gym, you know, hey, fat is just my body sweating. No, what is it? No, my sweat is just my fat crying.
Sorry, fat crying.
Got that wrong. Yeah. Pain is experience of it. Yeah. Well, you know, think about the things you've learned when you go back to, you know, where did you learn the most in your life? Where did you learn the most in sales or work? You probably come up with painful experiences, unfortunately. So the faster you want to grow, it's not that it has to be painful, but it does require change. And for a lot of people, change is painful. It doesn't have to be, but it just, you know, as much as people say they like to embrace change, companies do, like, really, it can feel painful because you just want it to happen now. So it's not a bad thing. I think it's okay to, any company that's growing, the faster you grow, the more problems there are, honestly. You just have to be okay with that. It's like, okay with it.
Yep. I compare, you know, the good times and the bad, and it's like the good times and the challenging times. And, you know, I think back to like when it was really good and easy, it was like, you've almost got your feet back. You're like, I feel like I'm missing something. This is too easy. You know, it shouldn't be this easy. And then when times get challenging, you're like, yes, this is hard. You know, yes, the world is potentially ending, but really it's probably not. You just sort of feel that way. But I find those are the times where you're sort of challenged to sort of step up a little bit. And those are the times when I've leveled up personally as a human entrepreneur, as a salesperson. It's like I've learned more from every lost. I've learned way more from all the lost deals, the deals that I haven't won, than the ones that I did, right? Because with the ones that you lost, I stew over them, right? And you go back and you're like, oh, what did I do wrong? You know, what could I have done differently? Right? There's like some motivation in there to like figure it out. Whereas when you win a deal, it's like, great, let's celebrate. And there's no reflection. I mean, ideally you should, like, what was right? What was, you know, what went well about this deal? But I find, you know, that typically doesn't happen nearly enough. And our brains are sort of engineered to, you know, react 7 times, 10 times stronger to negative emotions than they are to positive. So I feel like we're maybe going to learn 7. Maybe that means we're going to learn 7 times more from negative experiences than we are from positive.
I mean, there's something to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how we're wired.
Yeah. There's some real strong podcast math and insight happening right there. Just connecting dots all over the place here.
Yeah. And if we go back, if we wrap up the niche section.
Yeah.
So again, number one problem for companies that are struggling to grow, not the only, but it's the most common one. If you're like, hey, we're trying to get our growth rate up and we're not, like, we're spending money on sales, on paid sales and marketing investments, and we're not getting a return. Probably, you know, it's usually almost always either the people you have or the niche or the, again, most common major reasons. the reason why it's the first, the very first part of the From the Possible book. And one thing that we, just to wrap, so Kim Brown in the interview also talked about, and they sort of identified their five sub-verticals. Again, as specific as this, right? Transportation, which actually that's a really broad one, but machinery, fabricated metals, electrical manufacturers, and, you know, basically concrete aggregate manufacturers. Those are pretty specific. And then for those sub-verticals, and also even by certain use cases, they actually created different sequences, different drip campaigns to work to speak to the language of the people they're talking to. Now, I don't remember who posted on LinkedIn, but someone posted this note around, I don't write my cold emails. I listen to the words my prospects say, and then I use that. They write my cold emails for me. So the idea is you're really, if you're getting to the point where you're writing copy in emails or blog posts or social, whatever it is, how can you get into the mind of your prospect? How can you read their minds? And usually you can only do that through reading things they've written, what they've said, interviewing them. It doesn't happen from in a whiteboard where you're thinking, hey, let's just sit down and write it out. You really have to do a talk to them. So interviews are one of the most unappreciated, undervalued steps in nailing down your niche. So taking the theory you do in a whiteboard setting, who should we talk to, then go to talk to those customers and try to listen for, and throw them out often very subtly, but listen for those keywords and key phrases that really are their language, like the metrics they talk about or they use or the steps, and to put that into some of your, into your communication, your messaging, and however you want to reach them, because that's the level you need to get to, and also get away from the, we're the most scalable networked social architecture platform out there, which, you know, doesn't work. Maybe that's an investor's pitch, but it's not going to work in your sales and marketing copy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just want to go back to it one more time, because I love this piece that Kim did for SDRs. And you said it already. I just feel like I need to say it again. She had sequences, cadences, drips for every use case, every segment, every possible situation. So the SDRs didn't have to think about I've got this person I just talked to, how am I going to follow up with them? Right. They pick from the plethora of playbooks that she's made available, and then they can focus their time and energy on customizing and personalizing that particular interaction to the customer. And I think that's really where SDRs need to be spending their times, not figuring out, you know, the difference between following up on a Tuesday afternoon at 3 o'clock and 5 o'clock and 6 o'clock, right? If we can just have our teams focus on the customer and making sure that what we're saying and how we're approaching this is going to be most relevant and it's going to fit the customer best, I think that's where we need to be spending our time. And I love the fact that Kim put so much time into the sales operations side of things and made it super easy for sales development reps. And Kim wasn't the only one. You know, we had Brian Wilson on talking about doing the exact same thing. We had a few other people talking about making sure that, you know, you're making it super easy for your salespeople, or your, whether they're your account execs or your sales development reps, to come in and just sit down and do their job and not have to worry about the technical pieces. I think that's such a huge takeaway that I'm probably summarizing at least 10 episodes, you know, that we've gone through with that piece right there. I do want to say the next one that's sort of on my list was the, we had Bill Binch on from Pendo, and Bill was an early Marketo, not a founder, but I think early employee on the sales side, right? He was one of the early sales leaders, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. VP sale. I don't remember if it was, you know, VP sale, CRO, but he was the head of sales there at Marketo for quite a while.
So we had Bill on, and he taught us his hiring process, and it was pretty unreal. It lined up in some ways with, we use a process that follows the who book. If you've read that or heard me talk about it, as Who the Book, The Method for Hiring A Players by, I think it's G.H. Smart and Associates or Jeffrey Smart. It's one of those two. Basically, I think the thing that I took away, and we did it, if you're currently hiring SDRs, or you're thinking about hiring SDRs or salespeople in general, go check out the episode with Bill. I can't begin to summarize everything that everything he talked about in a short period of time. So check that out. The piece that I really liked is that it kind of, what he did really aligned with the who process. And then in one of the areas that I think we were sort of the weakest and is sort of the worst suited for salespeople, is the Focus Interviews. So if you haven't, if you don't know who, if you haven't listened to the episode, I'll line it up real quick. Basically, you start with a scorecard. You decide what are, so for the role that we're hiring, what are the skills, attributes, and sort of characteristics that we want somebody to be able to demonstrate. And it's all about what can you demonstrate, not what can you say you will do, right? So that's the first piece, is you sort of decide who do we want to hire and how are we going to score them? And then we put that down on a piece of paper, right? The first step is the screen. And that's in that process, you're just sort of, you're mapping out, what are you really good at? What aren't you good at? What don't you, you know, what do you want to do? What don't you want to do? What are your career goals? Who are your last five bosses? What will they say about you? Then you get into the who process, where you sort of walk through their previous last five jobs. And you talk about, there's a variety of different questions. I won't go into them now, but the who interview is pretty intense. It's, you know, I wouldn't say it's common, but we've certainly had people come to tears in that interview because they sort of realized that the things that they said that they could do at the top of the meeting were not the things that they actually did. And the who process, it's, you in order to do it properly, you kind of have to be a little bit less Canadian and kind than I was maybe comfortable with initially. But those two first meetings, super helpful. The thing that the Who book that wasn't super well suited for the sales role is you're typically hiring sort of the same persona on a regular basis. And you need that sort of gradient, or you need some sort of standard way of assessing which salespeople are better than the other salespeople. I mean, obviously the scorecards help, but I think the thing with the focused interviews is after the who, you basically get together with the hiring team and you say, okay, we've all filled out our scorecards. What do we, you know, what, where are the gaps in each candidate's sort of hiring process? And with the way we've done it in the past, it's very loosey-goosey. What Bill came in and said is like, that's wrong. Maybe not wrong, but that's not how I do it. It's like, okay, Bill, I'm listening. And they have three different focused interviews that focus on three different areas that are really critical to his sales process. And I don't want to steal them all because I definitely think you should check out this episode. Super valuable. But basically they have these pre-programmed sets of questions, and they get, you know, account execs, they get the team lead, they get the, you know, hiring manager involved in the process. And so it's not just the one person, but what I really loved about it was it's the consistency. Is every time you bring an account exec through, they're going through the same consistent process. And if anybody's listening is hired salespeople, you know that we are some of the hardest breed to hire because we're naturally good at talking. And we're very easy at sort of presenting the right things at the right time if we're any good at sales. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to be great in that sales role. And I love the way that sort of Bill had these three pieces, these three sort of sections of the focused interviews split out, because it gave them a really good insight into the characteristics he was looking for.
Yep. And you see these areas, whether it's sales, you know, meeting qualification and hiring, where, I mean, it's tough. They are more subjective typically. So how do you inject some, a little more objectivity or some more process? It's not like, you know, say in B2B, companies tend to buy what they need. Consumers buy what they want a little more impulsively, and businesses tend to buy what they need. Because businesses tend to have more people involved, and there's some steps that remove the impulsivity out. Not all of it. And I think in hiring and in meeting qualification, like the who process or any process where you can have some process to take the impulsivity out, helps.
100%. It's sort of on the note of taking out the sort of impulsivity from how we run sales, sort of transitions kind of awkwardly, but I think I'm making it pretty smooth into my call with Mark Kosoglau. He's the VP of sales over at Outreach. And he sort of blew my mind on how they do discovery. I've always been in the, I've always had the, done the, you said this, did I get that right piece, right? I think as a salesperson, you're taught that as you're at a very young age, probably 5 or 6, you know, and your sales parents said, hey, you know, when a prospect says this, you want to make sure you paraphrase, confirm you got it right. And I've been doing that for a very long time. And until I met Mark, I hadn't even thought to flip that around and said, okay, so I'm going to, so Mark called it diagnose and confirm. So prospect, you said this, I heard this. Did I get that right? Perfect. Now flipping it around on the prospect and said, hey prospect, I said this, what did you hear from me? Because when I think about our role as salespeople, so much of it is expectation setting. And I've had so many interactions with prospects that have become customers where we both said, you know, I said words, they heard words. And I said them in one way that meant one thing, and they heard them in one way that meant something totally different. And that discrepancy can be the difference between a happy customer and a very unhappy customer. And in some cases, we're saying the exact same words, and you could say those words to 10 people and you'd get two or three different interpretations. But I think as, you know, as salespeople, our role is to make sure that we're communicating clearly and that what we're hearing, we're understanding correctly, and that what we're saying is being understood correctly on the other side. And I think that's the big piece that I never really thought to do, was sort of talk to the prospect and say, hey, here's what I said. What did you hear? How do you see that working in your organization? Make sure that I've, you know, make sure that the way I described it is correct and is accurate. The other piece that I really loved is he focused on sort of that. And I totally agree with Mark that sales are won and lost in discovery. It's really good questions, not the pitch that's going to win you the sale. And I think this took me something like, I've been in a sales role for over 16 years now in a B2B sales role. And I used to think it was the quality of the pitch. You know, it was how much you smiled, how smooth you talked, how well you knew the product. And that's not even, and the more I learn, the more that I sell, the more that I close, the more that I don't close, the more that I realize that it has nothing to do with the pitch. By the time you get to the pitch, it's the icing on the cake. The pitch, the demo, the slides, whatever, by the time you get to you talking, the prospect has already decided if you've won or lost. And so it's really in that discovery stage where you're communicating to the prospect that, you know, all the important things that they need to make the decision. Does this person really care? Do they understand my company? And do I feel like they're the type of person that's going to be able to help me? And I think that to me was just really opened my eyes to how important one, discovery was, and two, the sort of diagnose and confirm method that that Mark talked about.
Yeah, I mean, trust me, with any relationship, whether it's my wife, kids, or work, coworkers, salespeople, that especially when you're moving fast and communication isn't what you said, it's what was received. And to stop and try to diagnose and confirm the confirm part. And I think that's really the basis for a lot of relationship counseling, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Of any kind, like communication. Here's what you said or here's what you did. How did you take it? Do we really understand what's happening here or not? So I think part of that is the trick of doing it on the fly in a way that's effective and knowing when it counts, because it can feel like it's slowing things down. If someone is constantly saying, hey, here's what I, you know, over-checking, at some point, like, oh my, okay.
It gets in the way.
So like anything else, you do it, it can be really useful. And as you start to get better at it, I'm sure I don't do enough. You sort of know the best times to use it when it's appropriate. So it enhances, doesn't become a distraction. But yeah, it really is such a fundamental source of problem of communication issues, is that assumption of here's what I said and that they understood what I said the way I meant it at home or at work.
Yeah. Here's what they understood the way I meant it. Such a critical piece. And I want to end with one last thing that's sort of on the subject, but that we didn't have the guy on the podcast, but Chris Voss wrote a book called Never Split the Difference. Probably one of my favorite sales books written in the last couple of years. And it's not even a sales book. It's a book on negotiating. And he talks about many different things, but he's an ex-FBI hostage negotiator and talks about sort of labeling and bartering and bargaining. And that book sort of added, just sort of helped me take up, if you're thinking about discovery, and definitely check out Mark's podcast, but also pick up Never Split the Difference. And I guarantee you will not regret it. You probably also save yourself a ton of money in the process, because it'll teach you how to sort of barter and negotiate better with your customers, which means bigger commission checks. Aaron, before we wrap up, when we're a quarter into 2019, so maybe just on a personal note, what's new with you this year? What's happening in your life, and what's coming next?
Yeah. So I was thinking about this because I was doing a pre-recorded video for these kind of 1,000 franchisees or franchisees basically salespeople for a company in Brazil. One message or one idea, and I was just thinking, well, there's so many techniques and tactics, right? There's 100 podcasts with us. There's millions of sales podcasts and books and blogs, or even at home. I just feel the struggle of like, there's all these things that we want to do. And the bottom line is it's really easy, or our default is to think that our eyes are bigger than our stomachs with the amount of change that we can actually handle. Change is a lot harder. Change is a lot harder. It takes more time and energy than we realize. And whether it's individually, right? How many people have said, I'm going to change the way I eat, or I'm going to change the way I exercise, or I'm going to change the amount of money I make, and nothing happens, whether you actually follow through or not? How many times have we changed things in a business and it goes sideways, or doesn't happen, or gets forgotten? And so that's just kind of a fact of life. And I think, again, it's the amount we underestimate. We just don't realize how few things we should really focus on to make changes in, and trying to do less, like focus on less things and make a bigger difference rather than just trying to do more stuff. Like, everyone gets caught in the stuff, emails and tasks. And I mean, some of that's important, but when we really look at how many things can we really do? So I think the bottom line is you just got to pick your number one thing that really matters the most. And a lot of stuff you got to let go. Okay, let's talk about personally. For me, like for a bunch of years, number one was kind of money and like family and money and things like exercise and health and personal hobbies and sleep. I would love to say, oh yeah, I'm going to make more money, take better care of myself, eat better, be other, but it's not how it works. I probably do literally have enough time to do it all, but I don't have kind of the amount of personal willpower, energy, and attention, because even one area can take so much energy and tension. Sometimes time, sometimes it's just mental energy and emotional energy and attention. I don't feel like I have enough for other places. And at work, it's the same thing. It's easy to say, here's 1,000 things we need to change or do differently, but it's not going to happen. So what's like the one big thing or a couple big things that we really need to focus on to move the needle, go back to a overused cliche? And with the big rocks, I can't remember who had this analogy, but like the big rocks, you got to put in the jar first before you put the grains of sand. So I think this is one of these lessons that you never forget, but you don't remember enough. And we need to remind ourselves again and again, yes, we do want to change lots of things, but reality is, if we can focus on one big thing to change and let go of a bunch of little things, we're more likely to make the change happen, because we're putting more of the what's required into the main change, rather than scattering ourselves too thin across more places and nothing happens. And we sort of end up just treading water and in the same spot 6 months later, or a year later, or 2 years later. Again, it's actually, whether it's relationships or personal money or business, it's a human thing across all these areas. So again, lesson is, if you have more than one thing, pick, put them in order. Okay, what's your number one most important thing, and number two and number three? And sort of like in a daily, time management, which is do your most important thing first before you move on to the next ones, whether it's in sales or business or wherever it is, because I feel it day to day.
I think it was the Rockefeller Habits that came up with the concept of the big rocks. And then there's a great YouTube video. We'll try and find it and link it in the show notes here, where there's a guy and he's got this big jar and he puts the big rocks. He tries putting the sand in first and then adding the rocks, and nothing fits. And then he sort of dumps it all out and he says, okay, well, I'll try putting the big rocks in first. And he puts the giant rocks in first, and then he pours the sand in and lets the sand and the smaller rocks sort of fill up around the big rocks. And he shows that, hey, we can actually fit quite a bit more in the jar. And I want to say it was, so I love that analogy. The book's called The Rockefeller Habits or Scaling Up. It was one of the two, same group. I think it was the Gazelles group.
I'll bet there's some story from 2000 years ago that
I'm sure
feels like everyone has timeless lessons, but yeah, Rockefeller Habits was a great one.
And then there's the Now Habit, which is, I want to say Eckhart Tolle. I might have that wrong, but
Power of Now.
Power of Now, Now Habit. There's a couple, but if you do a Google search for the unschedule, and they talk about sort of a very similar idea. They talk about scheduling, like looking in your calendar and putting the most important personal things in first, then you put in the most important professional things in second, and then you let the rest fill up as it is. And that's the best way to lead a productive and happy and healthy life. Because if you're not taking care of yourself personally, you're not going to be happy professionally and you're going to be distracted. So get in front of the personal things first, and the rest will take care of itself.
Yeah. What's kind of interesting is one practice is, if you read any of these blog posts or probably books on what seniors, you know, people who've gotten to be very old, like what are they lessons from their life? And it's always around spend more time with the people you love. And it's probably like the main ones, probably some others. So it's interesting. I think you can try to triangulate. Here's the big rocks I think I need to do right now. And versus stepping back to when I'm older, what will I wish my big rocks have been, and kind of make your best decision there. Look from those different viewpoints. And, you know, sometimes you do not one or the other, but you kind of don't forget the going forward, looking backwards perspective.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great place to end it. Aaron, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
We're definitely
got to get you on here more. I think we're going to transition now. This is the recorded part, obviously, because this is Friday. Our actual 100th episode comes out on Thursday. And if you're listening to this, there's a good chance, or watching this, there's a good chance that we're going to a live Ask Me Anything now. And you're going to get a chance to hear a little bit more of me. I'm not sure why you would want that, but you know, we're going to do it. People asked for it. So we're going to give them what they wanted. And there's if you paid attention to the marketing email that Mina or Julia sent you, it might have even been Aaron's name that it came from. But there's a Slack group that you can join, ask some questions. I'm going to be jumping in. You're going to take some questions.
Yeah, we're on there.
Perfect. And so jump in there, and I guess Colin from the future, I'm passing it to you. Right on, man.